The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Sam Adams. I'm the movies editor at the Philadelphia City Paper, and I will be introducing Neil Gabler this evening. Before we get started, I just want to remind you all to turn off your cell phones, anything else you have that might make noise, and also to remind you that if you do have cameras, there's no photography during the presentation. If you want a picture of Mr. Gabler, he'll be upstairs afterwards signing books. So I'm going to resist the temptation to quote passages from the book, since that is Neil Gabler's job. So, but just to lay the groundwork here a little bit. Like his most famous creation, Walt Disney survives these days mainly as a brand. Just as everyone knows Mickey Mouse, everyone knows what the name Walt Disney means. Safe, wholesome family entertainment, universal, and yet firmly American. But how many people have actually seen a Mickey Mouse cartoon? And how many people know more about Walt Disney than his carefully maintained public image? Over the decades, Walt Disney's legacy has been a bit of a battleground. In the 1950s, he was held up as the epitome of hard-working, up-by-the-bootstraps Americanism. In the 1960s, he was attacked as the ultimate conformist, a red-baiting authoritarian anti-Semite creating escapist fantasies to distract people from the problems of the real world. And more recently, the company that bears his name has become the symbol of globalization, or as it's sometimes called, Disneyfication, a cultural monolith exporting bland mediocrity to every corner of the globe. Now, somewhere in the middle of all this is a man, and it is that man who emerges, with all his genius and all his faults, from Neil Gabler's invaluable biography. At once an intimate portrait and a cultural history, Walt Disney traces the evolution of both Walt the man and Walt the brand, restoring him to the ranks of flesh and blood humans, and charting his almost unfathomable effect on American culture as a whole. As the first writer given complete access to the Disney archives, Neil Gabler tells his story in unparalleled detail, but he always keeps the bigger picture in view, which is to say that, like the best of Disney's films, the book is both monumental and utterly approachable. Now, in addition to this book, Gabler is the author of a fascinating book called An Empire of Their Own, How the Jews Invented Hollywood. His other books include Winchell, Gossip, Power, and the Culture of Celebrity, and Life, the Movie. He is a regular commentator on Fox News Watch. He writes frequently for the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times, and he is a senior fellow at the Norman Lear Center for the Study of Entertainment and Society in the Annenberg School for Communications at the University of Southern California. So without further ado, please welcome Neil Gabler.
I'm going to wear a wireless mic because I'm Jewish and I can't stand behind a podium for the evening. I have to move. So you'll excuse me.
Can you all hear me? All right, that's better. You know, December 15th, tomorrow, is going to be the 40th anniversary of Walt Disney's death. And it's interesting because here we are 40 years later, and yet Walt Disney is still a vivid presence in most of our lives in one way or another, and is still, as Sam pointed out, the focal point of a cultural war. There's almost no middle ground on Walt Disney. That's something you discover when you write about him, and it's something you discover when you're out promoting your book. People either love him and regard him as the repository of wholesome, wonderful American values, or they detest him and regard him as the person who degraded American popular culture and took the art out of folk art. Now, I came to this project in a rather peculiar way because I subscribe to neither of those factions. And when I decided to embark on a biography of Walt Disney, I did so not because I genuflected at the altar of Walt Disney or because I wanted to demonize him to prove how awful a human being he was, but because, like the other individuals about whom I'd written, those Hollywood moguls in An Empire of Their Own, the Jews Who Invented Hollywood, Walter Winchell, the gossip columnist in my second book, He was what I regard as an architect of the American consciousness. Now, I'll tell you what I mean by that, if it's not self-explanatory. He was someone who helped design how we think about the world. And of all the individuals in American popular culture in the 20th century, I think that Walt Disney is probably the preeminent of those individuals who shaped the American consciousness. And so that's why I came to this project. I wanted to discover the forces that shaped this man and the way in which this man formed what I call a double helix with the American imagination. And I thought if I could penetrate those things, I'd not only understand something about Walt Disney, actually the Walt Disney inside the larger Walt Disney, but I'd understand something about us and about America, which is always the challenge for me when I'm writing a book. And so I petitioned the Walt Disney Archives to see whether they would give me access to Walt's papers. That process took 2 years. From the time I submitted the application to the time I finally got a phone call that said, we are going to grant you access. What happened as that request wound its way through the bureaucracy, I have no idea. All I can tell you is that I was asked to come out to the Disney Archives and meet with the archivist, Dave Smith, who was the man who founded the archives in 1970, and with Howard Green, who was the senior vice president of corporate communications at the Walt Disney Company. And when I came out there, here I was flush with excitement that I'd been given this gift, and I knew it was a gift. All of Walt Disney's papers, and I was going to be the first biographer to ever have access to all of them. And I sat down in that archive between Dave Smith and Howard Green, and Howard Green said, you know, we believe that enough time has elapsed for someone to write about Walt Disney with some perspective. It's difficult to get perspective on Walt Disney because of what I said earlier. He's either the subject of adoration or demonization. And we think there's just a handful of people who would be appropriate to write about Walt Disney. And I say this in all modesty. They said, we think you're one of those guys based on your previous work. And then he said, but we have one condition. Now, you know when you Google something and in that one-tenth of a second, 500,000 things appear? Well, 500,000 things appeared in my mind in one-tenth of a second of all the things they were going to tell me that would prevent me ultimately from accepting the gift that they had given me. In other words, the Walt Disney Studio giveth, and then the Walt Disney Studio taketh away. And that's exactly what I was thinking. Of course, what's the condition? Well, we want to vet the manuscript. Or we've removed things from the archives that reflect poorly on Mr. Disney. Or we ask that you write approvingly of Walt Disney. None of those conditions could I accept as, I hope, a reputable biographer. And so I'm thinking in that probably millisecond before he said we have one condition, and he told me what the condition was, that it is all going to evaporate and this project is over. And then he said to me, the condition is, write a serious book. And I've certainly tried to do that, because I came to this without any agenda. I came to this simply wanting to follow the path and see what the papers gave me. Now, I'll tell you something about biography. Biography is a very tactile thing. You don't think of it in those terms, but it really is. And so when I got into the archives, I determined, first of all, that I was going to work my way through in chronological order. Now, that may seem logical to begin with, but of course it's logical for movies to be shot in chronological order, and we all know that they aren't. But I wanted to start with the very first document in the collection, and I asked Dave Smith, the archivist, to bring it to me, and that document was the deed that Walt Disney's great-grandfather had gotten to land in Ontario after he had emigrated from Ireland. The original deed, 1858, and I was holding it in my hand, that tactile sense of being connected to the Disney family. And I worked my way from that deed all the way to the final letters in the final week of Walt's life, December 15th, 1966, which is the day of his death. Now, why did I work through chronologically? Well, of course, you would say, because you want to follow the story, and that, you know, it begins here, and the middle here, and the end here. But there's something else, too. And, you know, it's so self-evident But you don't think of it until you start doing this kind of work, and that is this. We all know that Walt Disney is going to be successful. I wouldn't be writing a biography of him if he weren't. But Walt Disney doesn't know. And so as you go through this material, you hold in your hand a postcard on which Walt had drawn a picture when he was 10 years old that he sent to his mother, who was visiting her ailing brother in St. Louis. Or you hold in your hand his sister's graduation book, in which Walt had drawn pictures of girls on the face pages. Or you hold in your hand the actual letters, not facsimiles, but the actual letters that Walt was writing from New York in the fall of 1928 to his brother Roy back in Los Angeles and to his wife Lillian when he's trying to sell the Mickey Mouse cartoons. And he doesn't know if he's going to find a distributor because he made these cartoons essentially what we call on spec. That is, he had no financing for them. He had no distributor. So he'd made them on the hopes that when he went to New York, he would be able to sell these things. And so he's writing back furiously every day, wires and letters to Roy and Lillian saying, I think we may have a nibble here. It fell apart the next day. But I have a feeling Mickey's going to make it. The next day he doesn't. But when you stay in the moment with Walt, you share the tension with Walt. You share the suspense with Walt. You share the experience with Walt. You share what Walt is thinking. And if you're good at this, and I hope I am, it kind of, through osmosis, gets into you. I have a term that I call method biography, because I say that all biographers are method actors, essentially. You have to be. You have to find the things that you're in yourself that are attuned to your subject. And when you read the material in that fashion, in that chronological order, staying in that moment, it gets inside of you, and then, if you're good, you put it on the page, and it gets inside of you as you read it. And you'll suspend your information. You'll suspend what you know to stay with Walt as Walt travels on this adventure. Now, I said that Walt doesn't know he's going to be successful, but let's be honest about this. Walt always had a sense of his own self-importance. I would say it was inflated, but it turned out not to be in the final analysis, so I can't say it was inflated sense of his self-importance. Else, why did he keep all of this junk in this massive archive? Every letter that Walt ever received and every letter that Walt ever wrote, every memo that Walt ever received and every memo that Walt wrote, and Walt's memos were written on distinctive blue sheets of paper, the only one in the studio who wrote on these blue sheets of paper. All the other memos are pink or green, but you knew when you got a memo from Walt Disney because it was on blue paper. Every story meeting session, a transcription of every story meeting is in these archives when he's working on Snow White or Pinocchio or Fantasia. Now, I'm in the archives, and it occurs to me as I'm reading these wonderful story meeting transcriptions, you're seeing Walt in action talking about the animations. Walt, off the top of his head, saying something like, you know what would be interesting in Bambi? Why not have Bambi go out on the ice? And then, you know, his legs will splay because he can't keep his legs, and he'll kind of spin around on the ice. Well, we all know that scene from Bambi. But when you're reading these story meeting notes, you realize this is off the top of Walt Disney's head. He's sitting there, and he's saying, let's try this. And, of course, they try it, and it becomes a memorable scene. But then I said, I was asking myself as I'm reading this, wait a minute now. All the animators are at these story meetings, and all the story people are at these story meetings, obviously, and Walt's there, of course. So why do they have a stenographer there? And why are these all mimeographed? What's the point? All the people who are important, who need to know this information, are at the meeting. And as you delve into the material, you get the answer. And the answer is this. Walt had a stenographer at every story meeting, and he mimeographed the transcription of every story meeting, and he distributed the mimeographs throughout the studio, because At the Walt Disney Studio, Walt Disney's word was holy writ, and everyone had to know what Walt Disney was thinking. You know, Walt Disney was dead for 40 years. And in those 40 years, a number of the animators who survived, some of whom I had the privilege of interviewing, have kind of edged out and said, you know, it wasn't all Walt Disney now. You know, we were very important in this process. And some of the story people would say, well, you know, it wasn't all Walt Disney. We were important in this process. And one doesn't want to deny their contributions because they were real, and many of these individuals were truly artists in their own right. But they were not collaborators with Walt Disney because Walt Disney had no collaborators. Walt Disney was not a collaborative man. Walt Disney didn't think in terms of collaboration. Walt Disney wasn't interested in having a bunch of collaborators. Walt Disney was interested in what was in his head. That's all he was interested in. In getting what was in his head onto the screen and later into the theme parks. And if you facilitated that, great. He wouldn't compliment you for that because Walt Disney never gave compliments. Never. He'd never pat you on the back. He'd never say good job. That wasn't how we operated. He might tell somebody else, I think that guy did a good job, but Walt would never do that. But if you didn't help him realize what was in his head, he had a chilling term that I heard repeatedly when I interviewed people and that I even found in the documents. He's dead wood. Get rid of him. And it didn't make any difference how long you'd been at the studio. It didn't make any difference how prominent you'd been at the studio. It didn't make any difference how much you contributed to realizing Walt's visions in the past. If you weren't contributing to Walt's visions then, you were dead wood, get rid of him. Because Walt Disney was an instrumentalist. He was not a sentimentalist. So forget that. All these people who talk about Walt Disney as being this great sentimental, he's all weepy kind of, no. That wasn't Walt Disney. Walt Disney wanted to know, could you help him realize his vision? Could you be instrumental for him? If you could do that, great. If you couldn't, you were deadwood, and that's all he cared about. Now, there's something in this that is actually quite admirable because, I'll tell you, you know, you look at the other studios, and obviously I studied those and all of those moguls in my first book, and those guys were tyrannical. Louis B. Mayer, Jack Warner, Harry Cohn at Columbia Pictures, a real tyrant of whom it was said, Red Skelton made the remark, when thousands of people showed up for Harry Cohn's funeral, it just goes to prove what they always say, give the people what they want and they'll show up. But those guys were tyrants. Those guys cracked the whip over their employees, just the way that Walt did. But they did so largely as a form of self-aggrandizement to prove that they could, to prove that they were powerful, to prove that this was their domain, and to prove that they were the head of the domain. Walt Disney didn't need to do that. Walt Disney owned the Walt Disney Studio. He literally owned it. He was compelled later on to issue stock, but even when he issued stock, he did it in such a way that he retained all the control. It was the Walt Disney Studio. Now, originally, by the way, it was Disney Brothers, as some of you may know, until Walt peremptorily said one day to his brother Roy, who was his partner in Disney Brothers, 8 years older than Walt, the chief financial officer of the company, and he announced to Roy, from now on it's Walt Disney Productions. And Roy didn't blink. He said, all right, it's Walt Disney Productions. And so it was. And it was Walt Disney's name that was everywhere. It was Walt Disney who was the head of the studio. But Walt Disney didn't need to prove that he was the head of the studio. Everyone knew he was the head of the studio. So when Walt Disney cracked the whip, it wasn't for him. It was always for the work. And that's why I say there was something sort of admirable in this. Because Walt Disney believed. Walt Disney believed passionately. Walt Disney believed in virtually nothing else then. Walt Disney was almost religious about the quality of his work. He cared nothing about money. Now, that sounds like a press release. Believe me, it's true. Because if you read my book or you go through the papers, one of the things that is staggering to discover is that Walt Disney is always in financial difficulty. He's always on the ropes financially. He's Walt Disney. You say to yourself, wait a minute. How can Walt Disney be in financial difficulty? He's Walt Disney. In point of fact, I'll tell you something funny. When I interviewed Walt's daughter, Diane, she told me that my mother, that is her mother, Lillian, Walt's wife, said the same thing. She'd say to Walt, wait a minute, how come you don't make the kind of money that Louis B. Mayer is making? How come you don't make the kind of money that Harry Cohn makes or that the Warner Brothers make? How come we're always struggling? You're Walt Disney. Well, here's the answer. Because Walt Disney didn't care about money. Walt Disney cared about quality. Walt Disney cared about making great pictures by his own lights, of course. And sometimes, in fact, very frequently, in fact, most of the time, making great pictures cost more than they got back for making the great pictures. I said he was always in financial difficulty. Snow White was a tremendous success. Tremendous. Returned millions and millions of dollars to the studio, so much so that Walt could build a new studio with the proceeds in Burbank, California, which is to this day, the headquarters of the Walt Disney Company. They're so flushed with excitement and with energy and with a sense of their own infallibility that they go and make Pinocchio. By my lights, the greatest animation of all time, and it's a disaster financially. Meanwhile, they're working on Fantasia. And here Walt is really pumped up. He's so excited about Fantasia. Walt is going to combine high art and popular art. He's going to bring them together in this union, the likes of which has never been seen in American culture. Stokowski, your own Stokowski of Philadelphia, and Walt Disney together. High art and popular art. And it's a disaster financially. Bambi. Walt's going to go in a slightly different direction. He wants to make a more realistic animation. He wants to show that animation can do everything that live action films can do and more. And he works on Bambi beginning in 1933 when he begins working on Snow White. And it's not released until 1942. So for 9 years, the staff is working on Bambi. 9 years. Because Walt says, you're not getting it right. You're not ready yet. You can't do it yet. We got to wait until you're ready, until you're good enough. You know, they would bring a deer into the studio, a deer carcass. And day by day, they would strip away the layers of muscle so that the animators could study the anatomy of the deer. By the way, by the end of that week, there was only one animator who could stand the stench, and he would have to report back to the rest of them. But that's what Walt was searching for, that kind of realism. And he releases Bambi, this departure in Walt Disney Animation, and it's a disaster financially. The only animation that makes money from Snow White through Bambi, the golden age of American animation, is Dumbo. And Dumbo makes money because Walt says, let's rush it into production. Let's make it cheaply, $650,000, less than half of what he's spending on the other animations, because we need to make money on this one. We have to, or the studio is going to go belly up. The Bank of America, which financed the Disney studio, said to Walt Disney, we will not finance any more feature animations. And so the king of feature animation from 1942 through 1950 does not make a single feature animation except for those compilation animations with little pieces of, you know, short films put together to make a long film. But there's no feature animation in that period because Walt Disney can't afford to do it. He doesn't have the financing for it. And he's despondent by this. He's lived to make these animations. As I said, he lived for quality. And now he can't do it. And when he could do it, the company was different than any other studio, not only because Walt was not self-aggrandizing in his exercise of power, but because he so inspired those animators to greatness that they would do anything. They worked 7 days a week at the Disney studio, and they didn't get paid for that seventh day because Walt Disney wanted them to. They worked until midnight, not because they got paid overtime, but because Walt Disney wanted them to. When they were making Snow White, they literally burnt their hands and arms on the lamps of the animation tables because Walt Disney wanted them to. And kind of ironically, as Snow White was headed into its final turn to the finish line, Walt had to ride his animators not to get them to produce more, but his animators were so afraid that their work wasn't good enough that they weren't sending it on to the ink and paint girls, the girls who would actually trace the drawings onto the cells, and the girls who would paint the cells, because they felt it's not good enough for Walt Disney, so we can't send them to ink and paint. Because Walt's standards are so high, and he's inculcated that in us, that we don't want to disappoint Walt Disney. And so the studio isn't even really a business because it's not making any money. And it's not operated like any business that I've ever heard of, and it's certainly not operated like any studio I've ever heard of. It's operated, and I have a chapter in the book that's called this, it's a cult. The Walt Disney Studio in the 1930s is a cult. Everybody at the studio drinks the Kool-Aid, and Walt is the head of the cult. Roy Williams was a gag man at the studio, and later, some of you may remember him as the big fat mousketeer on the Mickey Mouse Club. And in the 1930s, one day he was expatiating to his sister-in-law, who was married to a minister, and he was saying how great Walt Disney was. And this, by the way, is not uncommon. To this day, it's not uncommon when you interview some of the people who worked with Walt Disney for them to talk reverentially about Walt and how great Walt was. I'll even tell you something. John Hubley later became a famous experimental animator. For a while, he worked at the studio. And when the studio was struck in 1941, a very bitter strike, John Hubley was one of those political radicals who left the studio and professed to hate Walt Disney, as many of those people did. Walt Disney was a conservative, red-baiting jerk. The day Walt Disney dies, Faith Hubley, another animator, John's wife, tells him, Walt Disney's dead. And Hubley starts crying. And his wife says, wait a minute, you hated Walt Disney. And he says, yeah, but he was Walt Disney. Now, that's somebody who hated Walt Disney. Imagine if you loved him. And the people at the studio loved him, worshipped him, would do whatever he asked them to do. And that's why they got the kind of work they got at that studio in that golden age before it all went away. And it went away in part because of that strike in 1941. Walt had moved to these great new headquarters in Burbank, which he personally designed, by the way. Walt was not a, I said he wasn't a collaborator, he wasn't a delegator. Walt would draw up organization charts, and then he'd rip them up. Walt would hire levels of middle management, and then give them nothing to do, and ultimately fire them. Walt Disney was not a man who could delegate anything about which he cared. And that's important, because there are a lot of things about which Walt Disney did not care. He would only invest himself personally in those things that he thought could be great. He wanted to be personally invested in nothing that he didn't think could be great. So long as it was great, There were no collaborators. There was no delegation. There was Walt Disney. And I'll tell you this. If you want to know who is the engine at the Walt Disney Studio in its golden age, who is the man who generates the ideas at the Walt Disney Studio in the golden age, who is the man whose sensibility prevails at the Walt Disney Studio in the golden age, it's Walt Disney. Even one of his animators, Wilfred Jackson, once said, you know, we went off to different places, some of us, to different animation studios, and we never did any good work. When we were here, we did great work. And that tells you who was the one responsible. It was Walt Disney. He was the one who was responsible. Though he didn't draw after 1924, though he never directed a cartoon but one, though he really wasn't even a producer in the technical sense of the word, though he didn't take story credit, he was all of those things and more. Then they moved to the studio, which, as I said, he designs himself, because he can't even delegate the design of his own studio to an architect. He can't hire an architect. And by the way, when he builds Disneyland, same thing. Disneyland is not designed by architects. He hires an architectural crew, and then he fires them because he realizes, you know, this isn't a function of architecture. This is an experience. And what do you need for an experience? Not an architect. He brings to Disneyland's design animators and layout artists, and they're the ones who design Disneyland. It's not designed by architects. Because, as Walt always says, Disneyland is not just a place where you go with a bunch of buildings. It's an experience, a cinematic experience. It's much closer to being a movie than it is to being even an amusement park. So Walt builds this wonderful studio, and he makes everything at the studio perfect. You know, if you're an animator at the new studio, you press a button and you can get whatever you want. Someone will deliver a milkshake, coffee, food to your desk. He had a sauna bath for his animators. He had a gymnasium for his animators. He had a penthouse club for his animators. You name it, he had it. And he routinized everything there, too. So to this day, you go to the animation building and the Walt Disney Productions campus, and he thought of it almost like a campus. You go there, and on the top floor, Walt would have his office and the story men. And they'd generate the stories. And then they'd send it down to the second floor where the layout artists would lay it all out for how it was going to look on the screen. And then they'd send it down to the first floor where all the animators were. And they'd draw it. And then they'd send it down to the basement where the camera was. And they'd shoot it. And that was the flow from the top to the bottom. Now, there's a problem here. And the problem is that everything was so routinized, everything was so stratified, that Walt became distant from his animators. His animators became distant from one another. Tensions began to arise between Walt and his staff. Tensions arose among the staff members themselves. Some of them got to thinking, this is so wonderful. This is a worker's paradise. And I'll tell you parenthetically, it would have been a worker's paradise, but Walt Disney wanted to add one thing that would have made it perfect. He wanted to build dormitories there so that the workers could just tumble right out of their apartment and go right to work. It was all so perfect that the workers started thinking, you know, it's almost too perfect. They started thinking about Walt as being not the head of the cult, but as paternalistic. They got to thinking, wait a minute now, this is Walt Disney Studios, and Walt Disney's name is plastered over everything, and Walt Disney takes credit for everything and gives credit to no one for anything. And eventually, these discontents began to brew until the animators decided they wanted to unionize. They formed a union, or they asked for recognition from the Screen Cartoonists Guild. Walt refused recognition. It launched a strike on May 29th, 1941, that lasted until September and that destroyed the studio and the camaraderie and the cult and everything forever. Walt felt betrayed. Wait a minute, I gave you guys everything and now you turn on me? They felt betrayed by Walt. You wouldn't even recognize our union. We're not even asking for that much. The quality of the animation declined. The esprit and camaraderie evaporated. And it was over. For all intents and purposes, it was over. And Walt knows it's over. Because Walt is not an introspective man, but he's a very aware individual, self-aware individual about what's happening at his studio. And he comes to that terrible realization that the animations will never be as good as they had been before. And that's devastating. It's devastating for a man who lived not for money, but for quality. And when he comes to that realization, he plunges into a deep depression that manifests itself by Walt Disney becoming obsessed with not animations, but with toy trains. Walt Disney begins to build toy trains. Walt Disney begins to run toy trains. Walt Disney lays track around his house on which he can ride on a 5/8 scale model of a toy train with an engineer's cap on his head. I say in the book that, you know, Walt Disney's midlife crisis was not women. Walt Disney's midlife crisis was trains. And yet, as he's playing with these trains, which are obviously a form of dominance, a way for him to do something that he wasn't able to do with the studio anymore, because the studio undergoes an awful transformation, not only in the quality of the animations, but in something else. You know, obviously, it's self-evident that the studio exists to make animations. But when Walt no longer cares about the animations, the transformation is that the animations exist to keep the studio going. And everything Walt Disney does is make work, just so he doesn't have to fire the animators, just so the studio can continue to run. And so the studio ceases to interest him anymore. It's just a place that provides work for people. What interests him is that train and what he can do with that train. And first he decides, you know what I can do? I can build a train around the studio. And we can have people ride around the studio. And he says, nah, that's not enough. There was a piece of property, a triangular piece of property across the way from the studio. I can have the train go across that triangular piece of property and around the studio. And he said, nah, that's not enough. You know what I could do? I can put a village there, and the train can stop at the village. I can put an Indian village here. I can have a town square here. And of course, by the time he's done thinking of what he's going to do with his train, he's planned Disneyland. Now, not even Disneyland, which obsessed Walt Disney, was enough of a legacy for Walt Disney. And as he got older, and the interesting thing about Walt Disney, one of the interesting things about Walt Disney, how young he was. He's only 65 years old when he dies. He's 21 years old when he forms the studio. He's 26 years old when he invents Mickey Mouse. He's 35 years old when he releases Snow White. And he's 53 years old when he opens Disneyland. And as he's edging into his 60s, he once laments, you know, imagine being known for the invention of a mouse. That's not the legacy that Walt Disney sees as sufficient for being Walt Disney. Now, Walt Disney understood what Walt Disney was. I said he was self-aware, not introspective, but self-aware. He often said that I'm not Walt Disney. Walt Disney is a thing. He once described it to another worker as, you know, Walt Disney's like Kleenex, it's generic. He said, you know, Walt Disney doesn't smoke, I smoke. Walt Disney doesn't drink, I drink. He understood that he was a guy and Walt Disney was this much larger entity. But he had to have a legacy that was commensurate with the image of Walt Disney. And so near the end of his life, He decides that having made animations, created a world on screen, an alternative universe, and then when those animations had run their course because they couldn't be any better than they had been, he builds the theme park, which is another kind of separate reality. At Disneyland, as many of you know, there is a berm that surrounds that park, and it is both a literal and metaphorical separation from the reality outside the park, because Walt wants to create a separate reality, a perfect reality. And by the way, you know, the appeal of that park is almost antithetical to the appeal of almost every other amusement park. Amusement parks generally, traditionally, prior to Disneyland, are about chaos. They're about overturning all the rules. They have the carnivalesque atmosphere in them, where everything is topsy-turvy. Nothing holds here. Anything can happen. Well, I'm just describing all the things that you don't get when you go to Disneyland. Because at Disneyland, order prevails. Everything is perfect. Which is the old joke about a cigarette butt doesn't even hit the pavement before it's swept up. And that, I think, is one of the subliminal appeals of Disneyland as well, which is that, as I say in the book, it wasn't the control of wonder that is so miraculous about Disneyland or Disney World. It's the wonder of control. That when you go there, you are in absolute security and reassurance and comfort that everything is under total control. But even that wasn't sufficient for Walt Disney, because at the end of his life, what he's thinking is, I am going to build my own city. And it won't be separate from reality, it will be a part of reality. And so he devises the idea of Epcot, not the Epcot that we know now, which is essentially a glorified World's Fair. Walt Disney's idea of Epcot was a fully operational city with a population of 100,000, the latest in technology, even a bubble to make it impervious to inclement weather. And Walt Disney would be the master of this city. And whatever was learned in this city would then be exported to cities across the country and around the world. And so in the final analysis, Walt Disney's legacy, as he saw it, was going to be that he was going to be an urban designer and a social engineer who would have brought his fantasy not separate from the world, but actually interlarded with the world itself. A legacy that, alas, he never achieved. Marty Sklar, one of the Imagineers who had helped design Epcot, came to Roy Disney shortly after Walt's death and said, you know, we've really got to build this as a testament and a memorial to Walt, to which Roy said, Walt's dead. And so was Epcot. And it will have been 40 years on Friday. Let me just end there, because I know you probably have questions, and I want to entertain them. So I thank you very much for being patient and listening, and now I will entertain your questions. Oh, thank you. Okay, let me, I've just been instructed. We talk about control at Disneyland, where there's control here too at the Free Library. There are mics that are going to be provided, and if you have a question, I have been asked to ask you to come to the mic or raise your hand, and the mic will come to you, I gather. So if you can be patient, that's how this routine will work. So it is, let's see, I think a gentleman over here. Yeah, right over here.
It's very interesting. I was just wondering, having gone through this mass of information and whatnot, if Walt were alive today, what do you suppose he would think?
About my book?
Your book, or, and also what he's seen with his company.
Well, those are two different things. In terms of his company, you know, Walt appreciated synergies because he operated on synergies in his own lifetime as a way of gaining sources of income to finance the things about which he cared. So Synergy was not something new to Walt Disney. I mean, he created that merchandise arm. He created a book publishing arm and a music publishing arm and ultimately distributing their own films with Buena Vista. So all of those things were done within Walt Disney's lifetime. On the other hand, Walt Disney abhorred corporations. He almost never attended board of directors meetings despite the pleas of his brother Roy. He was very disdainful not only of money but of the people who dispensed it, of bankers. And he hated size. He was always trying to find his way back to the early days when there wasn't stratification, when everybody was working in happy harmony. And when he built Disneyland, in point of fact, one of the things he did was create a separate entity, a kind of boutique within the studio called WED Enterprises, after his own initials, Walter Elias Disney, where he brought in a very small group of people so that they could plan Disneyland the way he had planned Mickey Mouse. Not all these big corporations, not all this bureaucracy, not all these layers, but just a handful of people in a separate place working together. Walt called it his sandbox because he wanted that sandbox. It was always a case of arrested development, so this is nothing new. So I think he would appreciate the size of the company, but he wouldn't have wanted to work there. How about this gentleman right here?
Yeah, he just asked what Walt Disney would think if he came back today. Let's talk about the fact that he may come back today.
Well, there's the question I'm often asked, which is, could Walt Disney come back today? And you know he's referring to the urban myth that Walt Disney is frozen, waiting to be thawed when they find a cure for cancer, which is the disease of which he died, because he was a chain smoker. Died, by the way, he was diagnosed on November 11th. He died on December 15th. He went just like that. He is not frozen. As I say in the book, and I hate to disabuse you of this idea, but it was fire, not ice, that claimed Walt Disney, because he was actually cremated. And his ashes are interred at the Forest Lawn Cemetery in Glendale, where he is as inconspicuous in death as he was conspicuous in life. If you try and find his gravesite, it's not easy to find. It's off to the side of a mausoleum, and you have to kind of wend your way to it, and there's a tree that covers the plaque, and all the plaque says is Walter Elias Disney. And even that was something of a concession. When Walt died, and he was cremated the very next day after his funeral, his family didn't know what to do with him, frankly. He'd never left any instructions. Walt was petrified of death, petrified of the idea of death, which is one of the reasons why this notion of his being frozen, I think, arose, among other reasons, but that was one of them. Walt never attended funerals. Walt didn't attend his own father's funeral, didn't attend his brother's funeral. There was even an instruction, I mentioned this in the book, where you're not to mention the word death in front of Walt Disney. You know, mortality was not something he ever wanted to consider. So when he died, there were no instructions for what to do with him, other than the fact that he said, I don't want a public funeral. That's the only thing that he ever said, he ever told Lillian or his daughters, because he thought that was undignified, and he didn't want a bunch of people, you know, flocking to his funeral. So they had these ashes, and they didn't know what to do, and they just kept them there at the Forest Lawn Cemetery, which is where his parents were buried, just like hanging around. And then suddenly his son-in-law died the very next year. And his daughter, Sharon, whose husband had died, and Diane, his older daughter, decided that they ought to bury them together. And so they went to find a plot where they could bury his son-in-law and Walt. Now, one of the things about this plot, if you find it, if you ever go to California, to Glendale to find it, you'll see that there is a statue on the plot of the Little Mermaid. And I asked Diane Disney, I said, you know, why, that wasn't a Walt Disney movie, I mean, it was a Walt Disney studio movie long after he died. I asked her, why did you decide to put a statue of the Little Mermaid there? And she said, oh, we didn't do that, it was there. And we just decided that, you know, that was the plot. Let's go over on this side, this gentleman over here.
One thing, I don't know how you could be sure that you got all the nitty-gritty, mm-hmm. if they didn't want you to have at it. Yes. They could easily censor that and put that aside and not let you have it. And and secondly, what role did he play in the nature movies that came after?
Well, the first question, that's a good one. You know, I mean, how do I know I got everything? Well, first of all, there are materials in that collection that would have been purged, in my estimation, had they purged them, number one. Number two, I can tell you, having been one of only two individuals who ever went through this material, and it took me many, many years to do it, you know, there aren't too many people who are crazy enough to go letter by letter, memo by memo, through this collection. I mean, you've got to be insane to do this. I always say that the most important quality that a writer has to have is masochism. And, you know, I've got it in abundance. So, you know, only Dave Smith and I have ever gone through, he's the archivist, have ever gone through all of this material. No one else has ever done it. So that's how I know, and I'm pretty confident, that it hasn't been purged. And as I say, there are things in the archives, and I mention them in the book. I mean, there are anti-Semitic remarks that Roy Disney made. There is a lot of racial insensitivity. There's all sorts of things there that, if you're going to purge him, you might as well purge everything. Why do it, you know, selectively? Why go halfway? Do it all, and only leave the stuff that makes Walt look good. And there's a lot of stuff in there that doesn't make Walt look that good. And some of it's in the book, not all of it, you know, because it's not a pathography. That's not my desire. Now, in terms of the nature movies, Walt was involved in hatching those movies. It was pretty much Walt's idea that they make nature documentaries. And I tell the story of the very first one of those, True Life Adventures, which is Seal Island, where he sent a husband and wife team, the Malats, to Alaska to shoot a bunch of footage, having no idea what he was going to get. And they shot and they shot and they shot, and Walt kept on financing them, and they kept on sending footage back to the studio, you know, hundreds of thousands of feet of footage. And finally, Walt latched on the idea. They had pictures of Eskimos and pictures of homesteaders and, you know, oil drilling. You name it, they sent it back. Their idea was, out of all of this, you'll have the story of Alaska. Well, Walt wasn't interested in the story of Alaska, but he found something that he was interested in, and that was seals. He said, yeah, I really like the seal footage. So he sent them to Pribilof Islands in Alaska and had them spend several years there just shooting the mating cycles of seals, and then brought that back and edited it and made Seal Island, which was, and again, this tells you how Walt's mind works in terms of business. Seal Island was not long enough to be a feature, nor was it short enough to be a short. I think it was 27 minutes long or 38 minutes long, something along that nature. But that didn't deter Walt Disney. RKO, his distributor, would not distribute the film because they said, what do we do with it? It's not a short, it's not a feature, what do we do with this thing? And so what Walt Disney did is he rented a theater in Pasadena to show the movie to qualify it for the Academy Award. It qualified for the Academy Award and won. And the next day when Walt brought in the Oscar, he said, take this to RKO and bash it over their head. Let's go on this side, the gentleman back there in the black.
I have two questions. The first is that my question is, how successful were the animators, since they were apparently those folks that fomented the unionization of the, of the company? So financially, how did they fare?
That's a good question, and the answer is, if you were a top animator at the Disney studio, if you were one of the so-called nine old men, the famous Disney animators, or you were any of the master animators. Now, the master animators are the guys, for those who don't know animation, who drew the extreme poses, as they were called. Master animators didn't draw all the stuff. They would draw one pose at the beginning, one pose in the middle, and one pose at the end. And then they would have what they called in-betweeners that would fill in all of the gaps. And the master animator's job was to create great poses, which was a very singular talent. And those guys were paid very, very well. There were times when those guys got more money than Walt Disney, particularly in the early days of the studio. He paid them more than he paid himself. They had maids, they had cars, they did very, very well. In-betweeners, less well. And the assistant animators who cleaned up the animation, because the guys who drew the extremes generally drew them very sloppily because Walt wanted energy. And he felt if you did it too neat, if you were too anal about it, you'd lose energy. The whole idea was energy. You could always have an underling come and clean it up. And they were called cleanup men or assistant animators, and that's what they did. They took an eraser and they cleaned up the extremes. Those guys did not make that much money. And one of the reasons given for the strike, among others, was that some of the master animators, a few, not many, felt that they had a kind of obligation to their underlings with whom they worked so closely to get them more money that Walt was unwilling to pay because Walt didn't think these guys were artists. So why give people who aren't artists the kind of money that you're giving the artists? It's one thing to pay, in the middle of the Depression, an Art Babbitt, you know, $300 a week. But why give this guy $300 a week when he's not Art Babbitt? Walt also, by the way, was extremely generous with bonuses. He always felt that if the studio did well, the employees ought to do well. And he created a very elaborate system of bonuses in which he graded the quality of your animation, graded how much you did, and then he had this whole formula as to how much money you would make based on the quality of your animation and how much you produced. Now, it sounds great, but the problem was that this built further resentments because one animator would say, listen, I didn't get a bonus, and that guy did, and how come he got a bonus, and I didn't? And so Walt, out of his own sense of paternalism, which he thought was really great, I'm going to share all this money with my employees, wound up creating greater stratifications and greater sense of strife within the studio. But he did, when he issued stock, Walt kept a large percentage of the stock for his employees. And then, at one point, when the studio's fortunes began to decline, his employees sold the stock, and that was another thing that made Walt angry, because he said, you know, he said, look, they didn't have confidence in me. They didn't believe in me. And he could never forgive that. And they were wrong, by the way, because when he built Disneyland, which is what finally got him out of his economic slough, I mean, he was so tremendously successful that the studio then did coin money after 1955.
The other question is a rather difficult one, I think, for you to answer, but that has to do with what was the extent of his anti-Semitism? How did it vent itself? How would you talk about that?
Well, I can talk about it. I talk about it extensively in the book, and I'm not going to bore you with all the details here, but I'll say this. I do not believe that Walt Disney was an anti-Semite as you or I today would define an anti-Semite. Walt Disney did not make anti-Semitic slurs. He did not exhibit any hostility to Jews. He did not refuse to hire Jews. There were people at his studio who didn't want Jews there, but Walt Disney was not one of them. Because let me tell you, I mean, Walt Disney would have hired, you know, Osama bin Laden, frankly, if he thought that he was going to make a good animation. And in a way, he almost did, because you know, I told you that Walt was a vehement anti-communist. But when he made Song of the South, he hired Maurice Rapp, who was a communist. And he hired Maurice Rapp because, you know, well, Maurice Rapp came to Walt first and said, you know my politics, because I don't want to, you know, come here under false pretenses. And Walt said, of course I know your politics, and that's why I hired you. I hired you because I figure you're going to read this script and you're not going to let any Uncle Tomism into the script. And Maurice Rapp himself said, you know, Walt would have hired anybody if it served Walt's purposes. Now, why is he considered an anti-Semite then? Well, again, to make a long story only slightly longer, and there are a number of reasons, and I deduce them in the book, but let me tell you the reason I really think he was regarded as an anti-Semite. And that is because in 1944, Walt joined an organization called the Motion Picture Alliance for the Preservation of American Ideals. This organization was formed, presumably, as it announced its formation, to fight fascism and communism in Hollywood. But let me tell you that they were never interested in fighting fascism. They were only interested in fighting communism. Walt was a vehement anti-communist after the strike because Walt's interpretation of the strike was there's only one reason that anyone would have struck Walt Disney, and that is because they were communists. That was his interpretation of the strike, and it changed his politics from that point on, because Walt was a non-ideological guy. Despite what people say about Walt Disney didn't care one whit for politics. He voted for Franklin Roosevelt in 1936. His father was a socialist who voted for Eugene Debs. Walt was not a political man. When he was building the studio, the war broke out, and one of his animators said, you know, how is the war going to affect the construction of the studio? And Walt said, what war? I mean, Walt was not interested in anything outside the studio. The whole object of his life was to protect his vision from the outside world, to create a separate world. So Walt joins the Motion Picture Alliance for the Preservation of American Ideals, which is an anti-communist organization. He joins because they're anti-communist. But, and here's the rub, the Motion Picture Alliance is also widely regarded in Hollywood as an anti-Semitic group. And most of the leaders of the organization, Walt Disney excepted, were listed among those people who were considered to be the most virulent anti-Semites in the industry. Even Louis B. Mayer, who was just to the left of Adolf Hitler, frankly, in his politics, you know, regarded the Motion Picture Alliance as anti-Semitic. So Walt Disney cannot be exculpated because he was a naif, but he wasn't that much of a naif. He knew. He must have known. I mean, I don't have evidence that he did, but I mean, he wasn't an idiot. He must have known that the organization was regarded as anti-Semitic. But his anger at communism was so great that he allowed himself to be associated with and used by a group of anti-Semites. And for that, he has been tainted for the rest of his life. Even though I don't believe, as say, that in any technical or personal sense, he was an anti-Semite. Two more? Okay. Well, let's go on the, let's do this gentleman. He's had his hand up.
Thanks. First, let me preface my comments. If you and I think the rapport between you and Cal Thomas is priceless. So if you guys haven't considered it yet, you ought to go on the road in a revival of The Odd Couple, perhaps. But more to the point, you know, conventional wisdom seems to be saying that two-dimensional animation is kind of going to the wayside at this point. And I think even Disney Studios has now merged with Pixar, or
yes,
it was up
have.
In the air, right?
Yes.
Do you think Walt Disney, hopefully you're still in the vicarious method biographer mode.
Oh, I'm in that mode.
Good, good. Do you think if he was still around, or you speaking for him, do you think he would view computer animation as a natural extension of his art or an anathema?
Okay, now you say several interesting things, because first of all, the Walt Disney Studio fired all of the two-dimensional animators about 2 or 3 years ago, all of them. There's only one left, Andreas Deja. Only one who was left who actually puts a pencil to paper. Everything was moving to computer-generated images. And then Pixar and Disney merged, essentially. I mean, Disney bought Pixar, but in the buying of Pixar, Pixar came to take over the entire animation wing of the Disney company. So John Lasseter, who's the creative head of Pixar, is now the head of Disney Animation. Now, that's interesting because John Lasseter, who has pioneered computer-generated images, is now interested in two-dimensional animation, and Walt Disney Company is making a two-dimensional animation, and they're having to hire back a number of these two-dimensional hand-drawn animators that they fired. Now, how would Walt Disney feel? I can, again, you're asking me to channel, so I'm going to tell you my own method instinct of what Walt Disney would feel. Walt Disney loved cutting-edge technology, always did. This is one of the things that makes him so peculiar, because we all think of him as this great nostalgist. There's Main Street USA when you go to either Disney World or Disneyland, and he has so many films that portray turn-of-the-century America, you know, in such a positive light. On the other hand, Walt was also a futurist. You know, he had the Man in Space series on Disneyland, you know, our friend the Atom. He was always interested in technology. So I cannot imagine that Walt Disney would not be fascinated by computer-generated images. But, now I'm going to get very metaphysical here, so bear with me. I think that there is a metaphysics of animation. And having watched all of these animations again in the process of doing this book, all these two-dimensional animations, because there were no computer-generated images when Walt was around, you feel the hand on the screen. You just do. You feel the spirit. You feel the anima of the animator. When you know that every single image on the screen was drawn by a guy. It's always a guy, unfortunately. There are like almost no women. I'll talk about that in the book, by the way. But there's something that you feel when you watch Pinocchio, you watch Snow White, or you watch Bambi. You feel the animator in the image. And they would tell you the same thing. They would tell you that they invested themselves. That's why they work so hard. I mean, animation is a lousy business, almost as bad as writing. And one of the things that you find almost invariably among animators is they had two occupational hazards or benefits, depending on how you look at it. There was a very high incidence of alcoholism and a very high incidence of promiscuity. These guys were either drinking or fooling around all the time because the pressures of generating these images every day and making them perfect is really, really hard. So I believe that Walt Disney would have certainly seen, as many of us do, that however beautiful, however pristine, however perfect, however three-dimensional computer-generated images are, they lack soul. You may not agree with me. I mean, I like Toy Story. I like, you know, Finding Nemo. Those are nice movies. But there's no soul in the image. You don't feel the hand of the animator there because, frankly, there isn't a hand of an animator there. There's a computer stick. And I think Walt would have known that. And oddly enough, John Lasseter does too. And I think what we're going to see in the next generation of animation is a way of combining the anima, the soul of the animator, with the tricks of CGI to take the best of both worlds. And I suspect we're going to see that in the animations of the next, well, now we're probably 2, 3, or 4 years out from that. And here's another interesting thing that I was told, and I don't have evidence of this. Walt had designed everything, as I said, at the studio, including the animation tables, designed everything. And when they fired everybody, they took out all the animation tables, all these tables that had been there for years, all the tables on which they had drawn Pinocchio and Fantasia and Bambi and Dumbo and Cinderella and Lady in the Tramp, and on and on and on. They took them all out. But here's what I heard about where they went. I was told that Pixar bought them all. And they were all shipped to Marin County, where presumably there are a bunch of guys sitting at the same tables where all those great animations were made, drawing with those lights under them. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.